This water symposium is comprised of partnerships with Texas Tech University, Shriner University, the Hill Country Alliance, and Texas Public Radio. We're really pleased with the Witte Museum and providing the venue for tonight's water symposium, and hopefully we'll be working with the Witte Museum in the near future on additional water symposia. So let me introduce the president and CEO of the Witte Museum, Maurice McDermott, who will continue with our introductions.
Thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the Witte. This symposium is very important to us because at the Witte Museum, our three initiatives are the following: water, South Texas history, and science. And actually, all of those are integrated in a pretty fundamental way. The Hill Country's in there, too. We consider South Texas really all of Texas, but not everybody agrees with us. And also northern Mexico. So we have a large idea of what South Texas is. But actually, if you look at the underground story, that's not so far from the truth. In 2005, we did a prototype, a model exhibit called World of Water. And actually, Robert Potts was very key when he was the general manager of the Edwards Aquifer Authority. And we just wanted to test it out to see what people thought about the issues of water. And it just shocked us. Even though it was just a little prototype exhibit, we had over 100,000 people in 6 months. The teachers and school children were the largest numbers. And from that came a series of curriculum developments that we do now. We teach students, we teach about 28 to 30,000 students each year with our partners, the Edwards Aquifer Authority, the San Antonio River Authority, the Guadalupe River Authority, and I'm missing one, SAWS, San Antonio Water System. And we see a growing hunger for the issues surrounding or embedded in the use of water. What is an aquifer? I'm really glad to say that because of the Edwards Aquifer Authority, we do have an actual geometric model of the Edwards Aquifer at the Witte that we show to school children all the time, because it's difficult to understand what these issues are if you don't understand our water source. Tonight, you're going to be talking to or listening to these experts. We're lay people here at the Witte. We're about informal learning for a general public. And so we try not to water things down, but we're very dependent on our specialists, Dr. Shepherd, Robert Potts. We're very dependent on you to help us teach the public about these issues, which are so essential. So it's our privilege to have you here today, and particularly to have this esteemed group of speakers.
Thank you, Maurice. It's really a great privilege for us to have this here at the Witte Museum. I think it's a great forum for this symposium. Tonight, my name's Robert Potts, and I'll be the moderator tonight for the symposium. We're very fortunate. We have three great experts to talk about this topic, and it's a very interesting topic. For too long, people have thought about energy issues in kind of one silo and about water issues in another silo, and they're really very, very related. Almost every big energy project that you'll be looking at in the future or that may be coming on the books is going to use a lot of water. And almost every big water project will demand a lot of energy. And so to ignore the relationship between the two as a society is really going to create problems down the road. And that's the reason we have this talk tonight and this discussion tonight, is to begin to educate all of ourselves about how important the two are, not only individually, but together. And to discuss that, we've got three great experts, and I'm going to introduce all three of them, and then they will be coming up and making presentations of about 15 to 20 minutes apiece. And if you will hold your questions until the end, once all three of them have presented, then we'll have time for questions and look forward to addressing issues that they may not have brought up or that you want to explore further. So let me tell you about the three people who are going to be talking with you tonight. First is Dr. Les Shepherd. Many of you have read about him. He came to UTSA less than a year ago to head the Institute of Conventional, Alternative, and Renewable Energy. Dr. Shepherd is a nationally recognized expert on this, subject. Before he came to UTSA to head this institute, he was at Sandia National Laboratories and has been working in these issues for a long time. And he's going to start out giving a historic perspective and talking about some of the national issues around energy and water. Following Dr. Shepherd, we will have Dr. Kerry King, who is a research associate at the Center for International Energy and Environmental Policy, which is located at University of Texas, Austin, which is an institute that really tries to bridge the three departments of geosciences, engineering, and public policy. And Dr. King has been working on energy systems and how they work together and how they impact the environment. So he's going to be looking at it particularly from a state issue. And then following Dr. King, we're fortunate to have John Brox. John has been working in this area a long time. Many of you may know him. He's been CEO of construction companies and has been working in South Texas and all over Texas for a long time, and has got a particular focus now on construction and how that interrelates with some of our natural systems. So I think he'll bring some on-the-ground examples of what we've been talking about tonight. So all three of these, I think, are going to be very enlightening, and I hope you will help me welcome our first speaker, Dr. Shepherd.
Thank you, Robert. I'm always a little nervous when someone calls you an expert. First, I don't know what it means to be X. And secondly, I'm not sure what a spurt is. But either one of those don't have very positive connotations. But thank you for that introduction. I would also like to say, as one that's new here to Texas, or just returned to Texas, I will say with confidence, after nearly 30 years of living in New Mexico, I returned to Texas as quick as I could. And this is a great venue here. The other comment I wanted to make is just a week ago, we actually had another venue, and I want to commend Maurice and those here at the Witte. We had an event that really focused on CPS energy. And for those of you who are from San Antonio and the surrounding region, or for those of you who have a real interest in where this community is going relative to clean energy technology, it was quite an interesting day in that Mr. Doyle Beneby actually announced that CPS Energy will be deploying another 50 megawatts of solar photovoltaics in and around the San Antonio area. And a very important part of that, from my perspective, is the economic development part of that, which is a requirement that manufacturing companies move here to San Antonio. And so to me, over the course of the last week, I commend the Witte Museum as being a wonderful venue to really help transform what I consider to be the energy and water future of San Antonio, the Alamo region in Texas. And then the final note I need to make, firstly, I'm just delighted to see so many people here. I need to shout out to a class that actually was supposed to meet tonight, Sustainable Energy System class at the University of Texas at San Antonio, who got to skip class because I'm here and I wasn't going to be there overall. So what I'd like to do, as Robert had indicated overall, was really there are a few problems that are as complex, as challenging, and as important as the notion of the energy-water nexus. And when you think today we live in a world where more than 1 billion people do not have access to safe drinking water, and when you think we live in a world where today our projections are that energy demands are going to increase more than 35%, and the demand for new electricity generation is likely to increase more than 85% over the course of the next 25 years. When you think about how we go about increasing energy demand requires water, and increasing water demand requires energy. There's no way around it. So what I'd like to do today as part of the introduction of this session is firstly provide you a context for the energy-water nexus, specifically providing insights from people like Mike Hightower and others, colleagues of mine from Sandia National Laboratory who have worked on this for more than a decade. I'd then like to provide a few insights and perspectives, if you will, on the energy-water nexus as it relates to the United States. And then I'd like to conclude with a few remarks that focus on Singapore, who really has developed a national integrated water strategy in part because it became an important concern relative to national security. As all of you know, I'm confident of this, 70% of the Earth's surface is covered with water. 70%. Unfortunately, 2.5% of that water is fresh water, and 70% of that, actually, is stored within the polar ice caps, I have solar on my mind, polar ice caps, glaciers, and permafrost. 0.3%, less than 0.5% of fresh water on planet Earth is contained within rivers, lakes, and streams. And about 30% of our fresh water is actually stored in underground aquifers, groundwater systems in the subsurface overall. If one were to take all of the water on Earth and put it into a gallon jug, one would find that the amount of water that can be used for human consumption would fit in a tablespoon. That's the dimension of the problem that we're challenged with relative to water overall. Today, in the U.S., the United States, we actually withdraw 345 billion gallons of fresh water each day. 345 billion gallons. Of that, about 40% of that fresh water goes to support irrigation and agriculture. About 39 to 40% of that actually goes to support cooling of thermoelectric power plants. In addition, as one looks to how water withdrawal rates have actually changed over the course of the last 60 years, from 1950 until 1980, a period of about 30 years, we have seen water withdrawal rates in the United States continue to increase. But from about 1980 until today, over the last 30 years, what we have seen actually is the water withdrawal rates have remained relatively constant over time. That in part is because of water reuse, a very strong emphasis on water conservation, a strong emphasis on water efficiency overall, and the deployment and insertion of new types of technologies. Now, having said that water withdrawal rates have remained relatively constant over time, we've also recognized that across the country, what we see is a decrease, both in the quality and the quantity of water that's available for withdrawal overall. Within the United States today, about 80% of water that's withdrawn is withdrawn from surface waters. About 20% is withdrawn from groundwater. And within the fresh water that's withdrawn from the surface, about 80% of that actually is fresh water. But we do indeed withdraw about 20% of our water, particularly to support thermoelectric power plant production, saline waters. So about 20%. California and Texas are the largest users of water in the country. California uses about 55% of their water to support irrigation, agriculture. About 15 to 18% of all electricity generated in the state of California on a daily basis goes to support pumping, treatment, and distribution of water. Somewhere on the order of 18 to 19%. At the same time, you should recognize that about 30% of all natural gas that's used daily in the state of California goes to produce electricity, which is used then for treating, pumping, and transmitting water overall. Fortunately, and there is a good message to this, fortunately, 345 billion gallons of water per day are withdrawn. About 100 billion gallons of water a day are consumed. And there's a marked difference, and it's important to be clear. Of that 100 million gallons of water a day that's consumed, about 80% of that goes, again, to irrigation and to agriculture. 3.3% of the water that's consumed daily in the United States is consumed to support thermoelectric power generation. Now, many of you from San Antonio and the Alamo region probably feel that water is an issue for the southwestern part of the United States. But in reality, water really is a pervasive issue across the entire country. Whether you be in the Southwest, the western part of the United States, the Northwest, if you go to the major metropolitan areas on the East Coast, the southeastern part of the United States, which I'll reference explicitly in just a moment, and Florida. And what you also will find are those areas where water use exceeds recharge at the greatest levels are those areas typically where demographers tell us the population is most likely to increase in the future. As we look to the future, because of many of these challenges, there's an expectation on my part and on the part of many others that we will continue to look for non-traditional sources and supplies of water. Here in Texas and elsewhere, many of you know, the oil and gas industry produces significant quantities of water. In fact, a general rule of thumb that I've heard is that a barrel of oil, with every barrel of oil that's produced, one generally finds 4 to 10 barrels of water is produced with that. In other areas, we're very fortunate to have a sizable amount of subsurface brackish water reservoirs that extend throughout the entire western part of the United States, parts of the central U.S., and the southeastern part of the United States. These brackish waters are poorly characterized. The salinities of these waters are less than that of seawater, but greater than that of what I would call drinking water, and oftentimes are fairly contiguous in certain regions of the western part of the United States. And fortunately, in many areas already, we are starting to use this brackish water as a source for desalination. In fact, for those of you from El Paso, you may recognize the world's largest inland desalination facility actually is located in El Paso, Texas, and accesses these brackish waters. Now, the treatment of water continues to increase over time. And when we talk about treating water, whether it be desalination or other treatment processes, you talk about energy. And what that does is starts to increase the cost and the price of water that each one of us will pay in the longer term overall. Fortunately, I believe technology and technology insertion can and will have significant impacts on the amount of water or the amount of energy that's required to treat significant volumes of water. It's also important to recognize that on a global scale, today we have on the order of 13,000 desalination facilities around the world. About 50-some percent of those desalination facilities are located in the Middle East, where energy is cheap, and they co-locate power generation and desalination facilities. The world's largest desalination facility is located in Saudi Arabia. In addition, many of you should be aware that here in Texas, we have on the order of 38 or so public water systems that rely to some extent on desalination and desalination technologies. As I indicated earlier, we do expect to see a significant increase in energy demand here in the United States over the course of the next 25 years. This significant increase in energy demand will, in fact, put increasing demands on water, whether it be in terms of production of unconventional sources of fossil fuels, whether it be the development and production of alternative transportation fuels such as biofuels, whether it be to address the challenges associated with carbon emissions as they relate to coal and gas-fired power plants, or whether it be to really enhance our ability to mine various types of minerals and extract minerals for various types of applications. One should always also recognize that there are many renewable types of technologies, and I will use concentrating solar power as an example, that actually require significant quantities of water. Photovoltaics require very limited amounts of water, generally for cleaning. Wind requires virtually no water. But when you start to talk about concentrating solar power technologies, one should start to consider the ramifications of water as part of that overall long-term deployment strategy. Now, in this country and elsewhere around the world, we generally cool our thermoelectric power plants using two different approaches. The first, which really was more popular prior to 1970, is what we call an open-loop system, where we withdraw significant quantities of water from adjacent water reservoirs and flow this water through a power generation plant one time and discharge it back into the reservoir. The water, of course, is turned into steam. The steam turns a turbine. The water is then cooled, and it's brought back into a water reservoir. The other type, and this, by the way, consumes or withdraws significant quantities of water, The other predominant approach is what we call a closed-loop cooling system. In that particular case, as the name implies, we actually withdraw less water, and we recycle it within the power generation facility multiple times. Eventually, we'll have evaporation, and we'll lose most of that water, and the water that remains will then be treated and either discharged back into the reservoir and or disposed of properly. For closed-loop systems, while we don't require nearly as much water for cooling, the consumption of water in each case is higher, and in some cases, markedly higher. So it's important to recognize that. Now, technology today is actually pursuing many other approaches toward cooling associated with thermoelectric power plants, and we're going to see significant advances in those areas in the future, including air circulation, including hybrid systems and other types of approaches. To bring home kind of the reality of this connection between energy and water and thermoelectric power plant production, it's very real. Many of you may remember in 2008 in the southeastern part of the United States, we experienced a significant drought that lasted over the period of many, many months. During the course of that time, significant water was lost through evaporation from many of the reservoirs in that area that supported 24 nuclear power plants in that region. Toward the end of the drought, they had to reduce the performance and the capacity for electricity generation at each of those power plants because they couldn't receive enough water to support efficient cooling of the power systems themselves. It's very real, and there are many other examples that one could cite around the world where we've had similar sorts of occurrences. So let me turn now to Singapore, who has developed what I consider to be an integrated strategy toward water, an integrated strategy toward the energy-water nexus, and driven in part because of concerns over national security. Singapore receives nearly 50% of its water from Malaysia. 10 years ago, they made a decision that this posed a national security concern. At that time, they implemented an integrated strategy that really did three very important things. The first thing they did is they turned the entire island of Singapore, and for those of you who are not familiar with Singapore, it's an island about 28 miles across. They turned the entire island into a catchment basin, if you will. All the estuaries turned into catchment basins. They built multiple reservoirs around the island, and they took significant advantage of large rainfalls that occur in that area. They didn't let a single drop of water go into the sea. That was option number one. The second thing that they did is they developed an integrated water sewage treatment system where they treat their water, and their water today, 2% of the water that comes out of the sewage treatment system actually goes back into your drinking water. The rest of that treated water actually supports the industrial base of Singapore in a very remarkable way. And if you're familiar with Singapore, they're one of the global leaders in terms of technology commercialization and innovation. And they have brought that to a place where now they produce something they call new water. For those of you who have been to Singapore, I'm confident you've perhaps drank new water. I'm also confident if you've gone to the grocery store, you can buy it in six packs. It's not exactly like Shiner, but it's close. The third thing that has really gone on in Singapore overall, in addition to these first two, is that they've started to rely very heavily on technology and technology innovation in terms of desalination. And so in the last 10 years, they've actually now, they produce 10% of their drinking water through desalination. Siemens is a leading technology company in desalination technology and really is leading that effort in Singapore. So in closing, let me just say that the energy-water nexus, energy and water are inextricably linked. Water is required for energy, energy production, for biofuels, alternative transportation fuels, for reducing emissions in a variety of other means. And also, it's important to recognize that water is required, or energy is required for water, in terms of treatment, in terms of distribution, in terms of transmission. Senator Pete Domenici, who was a senator in New Mexico for 36 years, recognized this challenge and was very, very fond of saying, "Mi casa es su casa, but mi agua es mi agua." Thank you very much.
Thanks, Les. That was a good overview. So my job here is to describe a little bit of the energy-water nexus as it correlates to Texas, and aside from the fact that it rhymes and rolls off the tongue rather well, and that we wrote a report called the Energy-Water Nexus in Texas, I suppose that qualifies me slightly for this. Maybe not an expert, but it makes me slightly qualified. So just like Les described, Texas, you might say, sits right at the center of the water energy nexus, just like the Texas politics is right in the center, right? Equally divided one way or the other. So maybe more not than the politics aside, the water energy nexus is interesting in Texas because it is kind of a microcosm of a lot of things in the rest of the world and in the country. So sitting right in the middle of the country, it's dry in the west and wet in the east. So we have a mix of water rights associated with Western practices and Eastern practices. And we kind of have different uses of water in the West than we do in the East. And so it kind of puts Texas at an interesting perspective in terms of how to apply things in Texas. And aside from a lot of people outside of Texas thinking Texas in general is a little behind on somewhat of the environmental movement, if you will, since we choose to sue the EPA over certain rules and things of this nature, our executive staff, if you will, the water planning process is actually quite admired and quite respected. And within this water planning process, there are opportunities to think about energy issues in the water planning process. And I've been a part of some of that, and there's other colleagues at the University of Texas that have been part of that. So one of these areas is in looking at the water requirements for power generation. This is one of the areas that the Texas Water Development Board, when they look at a 50-year plan for water use, they say, okay, what do we project the water needs are going to be for power generation, as well as other aspects that Les mentioned, agriculture, mining and manufacturing, which would include oil and gas production. I'll touch on that in a little bit. So in doing this report, what we found is Texas is similar in nature to the rest of the country. For every kilowatt hour produced, you can imagine about 0.4 gallons of water being consumed, so Les discussed. Water going into a power plant facility used to cool it, depending on a couple of different options that are the main way that power plants get cooled, or at least steam power plants get cooled. And that's approximately the number for Texas is about 0.4 gallons per kilowatt hour consumed. Texas consumes 400 terawatt hours of electricity a year. That's about 10% of the country. A terawatt hour is 1 watt hour with 12 zeros behind it. So it's a big number. And that's one of the areas in which Texas truly is bigger, and it's electricity and energy consumption in general. We also looked at the statistics, or I might say lack of statistics, on the amount of energy that's required to move and treat water and treat wastewater, as Les mentioned, as one of the main other parts of the water energy nexus. Which is, if you don't have the electricity or energy required to treat water and wastewater, then you lose your sanitary systems and you lose the ability to distribute water in a cheap and effective manner. And this is one of the main drivers, if you will, of prosperity and economic growth. If people do not have a stable water supply, this has been shown throughout studies of cultures and civilizations, it's hard for anything else to thrive. A water supply source that's reliable and affordable is a major prerequisite to have nice living conditions in general. So that's why that is very important. It's a high percentage of most municipalities' water municipalities' energy or electricity provision is a high percentage of their total cost, because that's essentially a lot of what they do. They pump water around and they treat it and they discharge it back or reuse it, and that takes a lot of energy. So it's a high percentage of municipal water budgets, even though it looks like a fairly small number sometimes on a large scale of things. Ways that I would say the country is moving forward a little bit due to a lot, basically really due to the pushing from the Less and the other colleagues at Sandia, is trying to get people to think and the federal government a little bit more about the water energy nexus. So we're involved with a bunch of the Department of Energy labs and looking at how is water affected by the planning process for new electric power generation in the different regions. So we're in charge of the ERCOT region, which is the Electric Reliability Council of Texas. So this is essentially the Texas grid, which is for the most part wholly contained within Texas, so that it's necessarily trade electricity with the rest of the country. This Department of Energy report study is also looking at the western United States, and we have the Texas part. But the point is to think about, to make states and regional governments think, okay, if I'm going to have power generation in this region, how is it going to affect the water basin that this power plant may exist in, and how might you plan where power plants are going to exist in the future such that you minimize the requirements for water or minimize the impacts upon water resources? Texas being a fairly good example of this in terms of wind power. Obviously, there's no water consumed when you have a wind turbine generating electricity directly within the process. And aside from maybe some washing of the blades every now and then, it's a pretty water-free way to generate electricity, just like photovoltaic. So aside from having air-cooled condensers or dry cooling, like Les said, these are ways in which you can, say, minimize the impact of water, impacts on water from having electricity generation. So that's kind of a side benefit, say, of Texas policies. Not that it was necessarily designed that way, but it is a way to think going forward. And people discuss issues like pairing up wind turbines with desalination facilities associated with brackish groundwater, like he said, with the concept of tying these ideas together. And a worldwide scope of this happening is in Australia, after they had severe droughts during this decade, and they were thinking about extra water supplies. And they said, and they also have somewhat of carbon concerns there at the time, and they said, well, let's put a wind farm offshore, connect that to a desalination for the water there, because they knew they needed more electricity to desalinate water, but they didn't want to cause carbon emissions, so they thought, let's pair these two ideas together. So this is one example of ways governments can think about how to solve the sort of a water and energy nexus issue together, and that has possibilities in Texas. An interesting aspect of Texas from the water and energy side is that Texas has dominion over approximately 10 miles of offshore submerged lands, if you will, which is more than most the rest of the country's states, which are about 3 miles. So what this means is, obviously, anybody who's been on the coast can see the exploration of natural gas or oil and natural gas offshore and near shore, and Texas can have dominion over this. It also means you can deploy wind turbines for the same in the same near offshore areas essentially no federal involvement if it's allowed inside this 10-mile range. That's also important for looking to the future for aspects like carbon sequestration. So part of my research, I work with the Gulf Coast Carbon Center. It's at the University of Texas, and they study carbon sequestration. One of the concerns about addressing carbon emissions from fossil fuel power plants is that if these fossil fuel power plants are indeed cooled by water, and I want the same amount of electricity to come out of these power plants and serve the rest of society, these power plants require energy to capture the carbon dioxide and compress the carbon dioxide, which then goes through a pipeline, which then gets injected into the ground. So this essentially means you get less for every lump of coal or cubic foot of natural gas that goes into a power plant that might have carbon capture on it. There is less electricity that comes out if you're going to capture the carbon, because it simply takes that energy required to run that process. So this makes it a higher water amount of consumption per electricity generation that comes out. This is relevant for Texas because there are opportunities to sequester CO2 in the Gulf Coast areas where the good geology is, as well as offshore lands. This has a tie potentially to be a revenue generator if there were a carbon price that incentivized companies to do this, a potential revenue generator, because the General Land Office has the dominion over these offshore lands. If revenues are generated on state lands, this goes to the permanent school fund and helps to fund public schools. So this is kind of something actually the land office is looking at and has hired the Gulf Coast Carbon Center to look at and advise them on the feasibility of that. I guess I think everyone here is around San Antonio can tell me more about groundwater than I know. I'm more of an energy person than a groundwater person. And perhaps the issue, one of the issues, is on the forefront more of the national and now the worldwide scope in terms of future energy supplies is natural gas from hydraulic fracturing of shale resources or shale deposits. This technology was essentially pioneered and developed in Texas in the Barnett Shale area, and that's where the initial technology was developed, and now it's expanded to other areas of the country, including the Eagle Ford Shale in South Texas, in this sort of this region and closer to the Rio Grande. So the first thought that people usually have when they think of when they hear some numbers with hydraulic fracturing is it's a lot of water. So for every well that you would drill, you will have about somewhere a single digits of millions of gallons of water that get injected to crack open the rock and extract the natural gas resource. So, you know, 2, 3, 4 million gallons of water for every well. For every well, it generates many billions of cubic feet. And if you were to compare the amount of water that's required to get the natural gas out as compared to alternative resources, coal or other types of, you know, oil, et cetera, it's actually a relatively low number. So if you said, I'm going to compare all these energy resources and look at the water consumption, you look at natural gas and you go, oh, that sounds pretty low. There's a lot of natural gas comes out of these wells. But what it doesn't tell you is, you know, everything else about the story, which is, you know, when you're in a particular geology, where you are matters. So if you do it in the Barnett Shale in this fairly water-rich area, there's a lot of surface water and the aquifers are fairly plentiful. The total water consumption in that region for the Barnett Shale production has not been particularly detrimental. It's tolerable with the region, and there are other issues potentially with trucks driving down the road and causing, you know, loud noises or things of this nature. From a water quantity perspective, it hasn't been to date a lot. So in a more South Texas scenario, that might not exactly hold, right? So understanding the context of the local resource and how much water can be provisioned for any use, but for example, hydraulic fracturing is important to consider. Probably one of the more keen issues associated with hydraulic fracturing is water quality concerns, or concerns that, you know, hey, what if something goes wrong during this process of extracting the natural gas and it harms an aquifer's water quality? Because that's so hard to fix after the fact, there's a higher, you know, concern for that issue. So what I will just say, which is nothing extremely specific, is it's important to express these concerns and to try to set up rules beforehand that where the rules can be assessed and addressed in a manner that set up a protocol for, you know, how to properly operate a well, make sure they're drilled properly, make sure they're cased properly and sealed off from the drinking water sources as much as you can. And, you know, for the most part, you know, the companies, you know, there's different size companies that operate and do these operations, small companies and large companies. So in Texas, because of the Water Development Board planning process, there are potentially ways to, you know, voice your concern. So I'd say if you're concerned, then, you know, try to be involved in this planning process. I think I might put a slight lead in to John's talk, and I'm not going to I'll listen and learn from him as well. Well, one thing I've learned working with some others at the University of Texas is how you use the land, you know, matters in terms of aquifer use and recharge. So one thing I've studied a lot is comparing the water needs for different types of transportation fuels. So if I'm going to drive a car on gasoline, or if I'm going to drive a car on natural gas or corn ethanol, 85% ethanol, or if I'm going to drive a car on electricity, what's the water associated with that process, right? So these have different units. Right, there's a gallon of ethanol, but there's a kilowatt hour of electricity, and there's a cubic foot of natural gas, and how do you even think about that, right? So you're like, well, okay, you can kind of go through this process and say how much water per gallon in a gallon is used to drive a mile down the road. So we kind of approximated it's a, you know, somewhere around 0.1 gallons of water consumed for every mile driven down the road on, say, conventional gasoline. If I think about an electric vehicle, it's maybe 0.2 or 0.3. Some of these unconventional resources, turning coal into a liquid, oil shale, oil sands from Canada, et cetera, maybe more, something in that range, 0.3 gallons of water. When you think about the biofuels, if they're irrigated or not, if you think about the direct water consumption, which doesn't include the evapotranspiration of the crop, which is basically a large part of the water consumption, that makes the big difference. If you don't irrigate it, it looks kind of like an unconventional fuel or electricity. It's 0.3 or 4.4 gallons of water per mile. If you irrigate it, it can be 20, 30 gallons of water per mile associated with it, right? If that irrigation occurs in an area where you're drawing down an aquifer, the faster than it gets recharged, the southern high plains of Texas being an example of an area where the aquifer is getting drawn down, not necessarily for biofuel feedstocks, but just for regular agricultural products, it starts to make you think about this connection if we are going to have a biofuel policy. If Texas were to join in on this biofuel policy instead of avoiding the government on this, aside from the quality of the feedstocks in one region or another, you can begin to think, all right, I've now tied agriculture to the energy policy of this country, right? And that's a big change from a decade ago. And how you raise your crops, whether you leave people who are thinking about growing grasses and are like, well, I'm going to have cellulosic ethanol now. Use this grass. Well, grass is on the ground all year. It means it uses water all year. Places where it's dry, the vegetation has adapted to the low water quantities that flow or that come from precipitation in that area, so there's not a lot of aquifer recharge. If you have an annual crop where you have, well, actually, I'm going to stop talking right now because I think I'm going to let him continue into it. So the point is, can you run manage your land to for water resources? If you use that land for energy feedstocks, this is where you bring into the energy water nexus. And since Texas has land that's wet and dry, it can potentially play in this area. In terms of the energy resources of Texas or the country. So I'm going to stop there. I think John's going to talk about this subject a little bit. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. King. When you talk about water, it's very complex. When you talk about energy, it's equally complex. When you bring the two together in the form of a nexus, that's where you see a lot of gray hair. I see a gentleman over there with some gray hair that knows all of it. We're in an interesting time, and there's a lot to be done. I am not the expert these gentlemen are, but I think you'll find what I have to say interesting. Dr. Shepherd talked about Singapore and what they were doing. There's other programs being done in Australia and other places of the world. So the point is, the solution for each region, each country, is specific to that region. Here in Texas, we have different challenges. And our state is so big, we have different challenges across the state. So it's a matter of finding something that is acceptable, that meets your perspective of what your water and energy needs are. For instance, just to throw some numbers out, in the driest year in Texas history, which I believe was 1917, the area of the state of Texas, we had like 14 inches of rain on average across the state. That equates to about 200 million acre feet of water. The wettest year in history was in the 1940s. We had like 600 million acre feet of water. The Water Development Board's water plan for 2007 says that by the year 2060, we'll need 21 million acre feet of water to sustain Texas. That's municipalities, agricultural, industry, energy, everything. The important thing is here, we have the potential of around 350 million acre feet of water every year falling on this beautiful state, and yet we're struggling right now to find 14 million acre feet, and it's going down every year. So we've got a problem. There's lots of ways to look at it. We have one. And I think from a regional perspective, you're going to find what I have to say something to think about. It's not perfect, but we're working toward it. I want to say that my journey to get to the point where I'm invited to participate in a panel of these truly experts in the water and industry is somewhat different. I've raised up through a family that for generations ranched in Texas and New Mexico. equally for generations, we were involved in the heavy construction business and still are in a minor way. We've ranched big. We've had the access to the bulldozers and stuff like that. We've built transportation, defense, energy projects, major water projects from the border with Mexico and Belize to the Bering Sea. So we know something about what we're talking about, and we have a little different perspective to it. I want to explain Aquifer Group. I'm the CEO of a company called Aquifer Group. It's an early stage company, and I want to read this so I don't get it messed up. Over the last several years, we've dedicated a lot of research. We transferred research. We've dedicated money, expertise, to go into a research and development program that is proving to be fairly important. We built up a team of world-class experts, from engineers to lawyers, geologists, everyone it takes to do this kind of thing. I want to read this part. Aquifer Group is an early stage company dedicated to large-scale water, energy, biomass supply restoration, and production. We're based in Fredericksburg. The company focuses on adding newer developed water to our supply by reducing evaporation and evapotranspiration. Remember me saying that we get somewhere around 350 million acre-feet falling on this state every year. Depending on whose numbers you trust, we lose 100 million acre-feet a year to evaporation. For instance, some from lakes in Austin, around Austin. Lake Travis loses 50% of its water to evaporation. Surface lakes may not be the solution. Choke Canyon, we were one of the contractors on Choke Canyon, know the lake well. It loses 75% of its water in a hot year. So evaporation is a big problem. Evapotranspiration, we lose, depending on who you believe, between 100 and 300 million acre-feet of water a year to evapotranspiration. A large part of that goes to invasive species that have come in since the drought of the 50s. Aquifer Group holds more sustainable groundwater rights than any entity in the state of Texas. So we kind of know what we're talking about when it comes to groundwater, as much as anyone knows what they're talking about when it comes to groundwater. Our core product is identifying and enhancing and restoring lost natural recharge. And we've got, throughout the world, there's been a significant amount of viable recharge lost to siltation. A clay layer forms over a recharge structure. Erosion moves the water supply away. We can identify these features and restore them. That's our core business. That water then is placed in a confined and non-evaporative aquifer, usually a depleted aquifer such as the Carrizo, where it can be stored and recovered on demand. We can use that water in time of emergency, drought, but that water parks there and it does not evaporate nor go away. Footprint on the top of the ground is like 5% of that of another lake. So it has its advantages. There's five sources of water that we can divert into recharge. They're all excess and appropriated and permitted water sources. But this is not what I'm here to talk about. I'm here to talk about the water energy nexus. So having given you a background, I'm going to change gears a bit. A few years ago, when we were looking into the water supply for recharge, we started looking for a non-appropriated source of water. From past experience, we knew that if we cleared brush, we could reduce the amount of water lost to mesquite and cedar. But we also knew if it wasn't done specifically and right, we were just clearing brush. It didn't increase the water. So we have a technology that was developed in the early 1980s that was the basis for locating recharge structures. We modified that. We have some really smart people out of NASA and JPL that have helped develop this technology. It uses remote sensing. It uses data mining and a lot of expertise to look at the Earth's crust. We asked this technology to look not where water went in the ground, but find us places where rainfall would hit and run off. We were able to achieve this. We also found an interesting fact that we don't know what it means yet. It appears on these areas where the water tends to run off is contrary. that tends to be where the mesquite and cedar is the most dense. So anyway, we're able to use mechanical means and GPS-controlled bulldozers and a whole bunch of things to carefully clear, restore, revegetate with native grasses if the landowner wants that, and keep this brush off to increase runoff into the creeks and rivers. So we discovered a way to theoretically increase the water supply. But we run into, every time we would solve a problem, we'd run into another, we'd come to a solution, we'd run into a problem. We're talking about, on the scale we're talking about millions of tons of brush a year, thousands and thousands of acres. In the past, and I've cleared a lot of brush, you pile it up, let it dry out, wait for a nice rainy day, and you throw a match at it. We're talking about too much. Too much burning, too much smoke, too much pollution. So we went to look for a use for this brush. The General Land Office has been mentioned several times here. General Land Office in Texas under Commissioner Patterson has really been proactive in trying to increase our water supplies, utilize land, the wind farms, various other things that they're into. They asked us to present at their Border Energy Expo 2 or 3 years ago, which is an event that brings the states of Mexico and the states of the United States, the border states, together to discuss water and mainly energy synergies. We were there. We talked about this brush, and we were talking mainly about clearing brush along the lower Rio Grande, and we had found that we could put 150 to 200,000 acre feet of new water into that river every year when it rains, by just simply going in and clearing a small amount of the brush in critical spots. What we didn't know was the brush was of interest to most people. Coming out of that, we were besieged by people from Europe, from Mexico, the United States, that are interested in taking this brush and burning it to make electricity, carbon neutral electricity. We had people coming wanting to take and pelletize and export this wood in the form of wood pellets to places like Europe, where they've outlawed coal and increased on and insist on using wood to fire their power plants. We've had biofuel people come see us. We have algae people descending on us. It's become a really, really interesting problem. So what the facts of the water to energy biomass piece that I want to focus on, these are the things we found. We found a unrecognized supply of energy. We found huge quantities of woody biomass that does not show up on any map of biomass you see published by the people that are supposed to study biomass feedstock supplies. If you've been west of here or south of here, there's a bit of mesquite. If you go north of here, there's a lot of juniper, cedar. We have a huge amount of this biomass. We found that if we very carefully, specifically, cleared less than 30% of the existing cedar and mesquite over a 30-year period, not much, on each watershed, it supplied millions of tons of biomass feedstock every year. Millions of tons. This is a huge amount. The resource is sustainable and it's renewable. We spend a lot of time educating non-Texans as to what mesquite, juniper, cedar, weesach, black brush, white brush is. They don't have a clue. Other than a pine tree, they can't recognize it. As an energy source, this stuff is very high BTU. It's very, very low moisture. It can be harvested year-round. There are not alternative uses for it. It can be priced economically, and it's certainly abundant. Every time I think about this, I have I'm from West Texas, so I have to tell stories, so bear with me a minute. I was raised in the, of course, in the late 40s and early 50s. I remember the drought of the 50s. What we had a few months ago or a year or two ago was an inconvenience. The drought of the 50s was a drought. And any of you here that are old enough to remember it, remember ecosystems completely collapsing. What we, My dad had bought a ranch in the late 40s, early 50s on the Leon River in Correll County. He had cleared this brush because we had the bulldozers. Made a national park out of it. Cleared brush, built tanks, cleaned it up. Just as the drought was getting going, we bought a similar ranch adjacent to it. Same size, same watershed, same topography, everything. I remember as a boy, 9, 10 years old, during the drought, we had to work down there a lot because we had to haul water, we had to feed our livestock and stuff like that. On the improved ranch, springs ran all the way through the drought. We had water in the wells all the way through the drought. On the adjacent track, same ground that had not been cleaned up, we had no water, there were no springs anymore, there was no grass or anything. But back to creating value out of mesquite and cedar, the thing that always walks across my mind. I'm the oldest child in my family. That means I was the slave back then. So anyway, we would go down, my father and I would go down every weekend to this ranch or other ranches that we had, and the ecosystem had collapsed. The only thing that would grow in these beautiful river bottom fields was kookaburras and occasionally some Johnson grass. The cattle, although we were feeding them, the goats would graze in these kookaburras. The kookaburras would cut their mouth. This was a time of screwworm. Anytime there was an open sore or anything, you had a real problem. It was a nasty, nasty thing. We would go down and mow, poison, do anything to get rid of kookaburras. Up under the trees, you hoed them to get them out of there. One evening late, we're sitting under on a big old stump on the banks of the dry Leon River. My dad's sitting there, and he always calls me boy. And we look out over, still got acres of this stuff to get rid of out there. He said, boy, just about as soon as we get rid of these kookaburras, somebody will find a use for them. I think about that in mesquite. We may be on the verge for finding a use for mesquite. I'm not anti-mesquite. Remember, we're talking about 30%. I love big, beautiful mesquite trees, but it's kind of got out of hand in some ways. So back to the story. Some facts we found out. These are preliminary, but we think they're pretty correct. There is more research to be done, and it's going to take Dr. King. It's going to take Dr. Shepherd and others to help us prove. We work closely with Tom Ersurfi of Texas Tech on this stuff. Aside from lowering the cost of restoring water and creating job opportunities, rural economic development, carefully located, controlled, and limited harvesting of this brush restores ecosystems, restores spring flows, and restores habitats. It's good if not done too much. You have to be careful. On average, for each megawatt equivalent of carbon neutral renewable power produced, evapotranspiration is reduced, and 35 acre feet of water is restored to the ecosystem. For every megawatt, we restore 35 acre feet of water in an average rainfall year. When compared, Dr. King touched on this, when compared to ethanol fuels that are a result of irrigated crops such as corn or soy, the water consumption to produce a 1,000 BTUs, a million BTUs, of power from soy or corn that's irrigated can range from 2,500 gallons to 75,000 gallons. That's where we're talking about the use a gallon, 2 gallons a mile of water, water to go a mile with this stuff. Not that I've got anything against it, but there's other ways. Woody biomass harvested as part of watershed restoration. That doesn't mean just go out and clear some mesquite or cedar and say this is biomass. But when it's cleared to increase that runoff, restores. It actually produces somewhere between 6,000 and 8,500 gallons of water for each million BTUs of power restored. Wind is somewhat neutral. Everything else consumes water to make the energy. I'm not talking about running the electric plant or anything. I'm talking about to produce the chunk of coal or the natural gas. This is the only feedstock that appears to increase the amount of water we have. statewide impact. This is where it gets really important, and talking about my little regional perspective on this thing. The Water Development Board's report, Water Report 2000 or 2007, says that in the year 2010, the state of Texas will consume about 755 million acre feet of water for energy purpose, to produce energy in the state of Texas. They predict that by the year 2060, which is the end of this report cycle, that the state of Texas will consume 1.5 million acre feet of water each year to produce power, electricity. This is just for steam and electric. Doesn't include the desal plants or any of the other stuff. But it's still a big number when we have a water supply that is dropping toward 14 million acre feet. It's very important. Early numbers of what we're doing on watershed restoration alone indicate that if we start this program and continue it for 20 years, at the end of 2060, water that's restored as a result of watershed restoration equals 1.8 million acre feet per year on average. Clearing brush may replace the amount of water that's being used to produce electricity and steam by about 300,000 acre feet. Wouldn't that be a beautiful thing for the state of Texas? I mean, we're leading the nation in wind power. We're going fast in solar. All of a sudden, we're making water when we make electricity. That's pretty heavy duty. So it's intriguing to us. And to close, I'm probably running out of time here, and I appreciate y'all hearing me out on this thing. The water energy nexus has to be considered in one piece. We've added one component to it. Mainly it makes it easier to say. We call it the water energy biomass nexus, the web nexus. It's something that the state needs to study. As Moore's learned, we're finding widespread support from landowners, energy producers, various stakeholders. We're still learning. Use of invasive species, development of new electricity that can literally be developed under existing transmission lines is attractive. We're finding major power lines everywhere we're talking about putting one of these plants. It's got a lot of things. It's financially viable. It's common sense. It works. What I asked help on is that this water energy nexus solution be included in a robust statewide plan to overcome growing water deficits. To do that, we're going to have to do a lot more research. We're going to have to do development. We're going to have to do pilot programs to prove it up so that we can demonstrate it. We have some people that are a little bit east of us here that if they can't see it, they can't understand it. So we'd like your help. If you agree with what we're doing, we have information on our website. Please look at it. We think we have an interesting alternative to be considered, and I appreciate your time very much. Thank you.
Well, this is a rich topic, and we want to hear from you and hear the questions that you have for these panelists. We've got a lot of folks here, so if you, as you're thinking about your question, think about how you can ask it concisely, because we want to have time for as many questions as possible. And we've got a microphone here, so if you would come up here, and we'll just take you in the order that you arrive. Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you very much for each of your topics today. I thought it was wonderful. I had one really quick question, and that is, how much of San Antonio's energy is used to pump and treat water? Does anybody know?
I don't know. We try to get some similar numbers from Austin, and strangely, you would think with a city-owned municipality that it would be a little easier to know.
Actually, I don't know that data, but I know the data are readily available. And if you give me your business card, I can actually find that. I know that CPS Energy is been in the process, actually, of developing what I will call an energy water report to really look at forecasts for the future, both in terms of energy production for electricity generation and water consumption that would be required to support that. And so I can put you in contact both with the expert that actually prepared that report as well as probably get you the information you request.
Okay, great. And the second one is about solar water pumps. And I'm not talking about these fancy renewable pumps or solar technology, but the solar-driven water cycle, solar power that distills the water from surface water or the ocean, solar-powered trees that act as pumps that pump clean groundwater, sequester carbon, and pollute clean oxygen, and then solar winds that drive and transport this purified water inland for free, and gravity that delivers it to our rooftops, again, for free. So, rainwater collection. Any prospects or thoughts?
I don't have anything particular that don't prevent anybody from doing it, I would say, if they want. Some states, you know, it's illegal, and some states are changing. Colorado changed recently, but...
It's being done in the Hill Country, and some people get in their entire water source from rainwater collection. I know there have been some seminars done on rainwater collection in this area. Cibolo Nature Center, I know, regularly does rainwater collection systems. Frederick Berg, John Kite is a great advocate for that, and has demonstrated that it works as a total source of water.
Right.
So, and I know there are folks in Austin that do it.
Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center is an example of that.
We have a rainwater catchment from the old cisterns on our house and on the previous home. We live in Fredericksburg, and it's very much part of it. We don't rely on it. We use the water for gardening and stuff like that. But rainwater catchment is viable. It's been around much longer than our utility systems have. We've just kind of gotten spoiled a bit to things are easy. We turn the tap on and we got water. It's a good way to go. It really is.
Thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I don't really have a question. I have a little short announcement I wanted to make. There are some UTSA building technology students here, and I just want to let them know there's a sign-up sheet at the table at the back before they leave. And then I also want to let you guys know there's a fracking talk here in 6 weeks at the Witte. It's the Dr. Cyrus Reed of the Sierra Club States chapter is going to present a thing on the on the Eagle Ford fracking impact. So we'd like you to try to, you know, come or let your classes or your groups know about that too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I heard a lot of good ideas and what you can do with energy and water, but I was missing the point of educating the public, educating in schools, that people can know how to conserve water and what they can do not to waste water. And when we talk about that, our lawns out there that are watered by sprinkler systems, and I think you have the numbers, that's huge numbers of water we just use, that we have a nice green lawn that's normally not natural at all, maybe in Houston, but not in San Antonio and not in the Hill Country. So do you have numbers on that, what we could do if we would educate the people and inform them what they can do to conserve water?
Question about conservation or education of water conservation. I think Maurice mentioned early on that the Witte is very involved with education on water. I know that the San Antonio Water System, the Edwards Aquifer Authority, Sarah, all have very active water conservation programs in the schools here in San Antonio and in the region. I don't know if any of the panelists have anything to add to that.
One of the areas we work on is to try to create outreach tools in general about energy, and part of that is water. And we have one. We worked with a nonprofit here in Texas called Power Across Texas, and there's if you search for that online, you can find a website that has what we call a trade-off tool. It can change the amount of power you sort of theoretically generate from wind or natural gas, coal, et cetera, and see whether water consumption goes up or goes down, or if more CO2 emissions go up or down, and land use goes up or down. So
It's a very basic tool for the first time. If no one's ever thought of that there might be a connection, it sort of introduces that concept, and we're working on other concepts. But in terms of an actual water educational program, I don't personally have one.
There is more going on now than was 5 years ago, so that is encouraging.
The comment I would make is twofold. Firstly, you raise a great point about education, and you know, to me, I don't like to miss an opportunity to just emphasize so strongly science, technology, engineering, and math. How critically important it is to bring that into the classroom in a way that's relevant. And at least my experience today, and I've seen an evolution over time, is that our young people, those in mid-school and those in grade school, start to understand the topics around water, they start to understand the topics around energy, and they start to understand the topics around climate. It's a vehicle to engage their hearts and minds in a way that actually will allow them to apply their science, engineering, and math skills in a meaningful way. Our challenge, and I believe this is a challenge for this entire community, is how do we bring this into the classroom at the earliest possible stages? And for me, that means kindergarten, first and second grade, to start to allow them to understand the importance of these issues around sustainability in its broadest context.
Absolutely.
For us to do that, I believe we have to work through teachers. And I happen to believe we have to work through master teachers, those who have demonstrated exceptional skills in the classroom, to work with other teachers to bring it into the classroom. Your question is absolutely right on, and it's extraordinarily important for San Antonio, Texas, and the country.
And we need people like you to bring in our tests that the government is doing in schools. One question about water conservation. If there would be, we talk to many teachers and they come to our place, we have a nature preserve here, and they tell us if it would be one question in the test, then we can teach it. But we have to drill our students for the test.
Yes. Thank you for the question. Yes, sir.
I'm Tommy John. Like Peter, I'm from Bandera County. Just an aside, I actually have a rainwater collection system that I use for my domestic water. You can spend as much money as you want to on one of those things, but I find mine's cheaper than what I could have put in a deep well. But that's not what I wanted to ask about. I'm involved in the combined heat and power cogeneration industry. I have a question specifically for Dr. King. About 15 to 20% of our electric energy in Texas comes from combined heat and power cogeneration, and it uses no water. But unlike wind and solar, it's dependable and dispatchable, and the studies have shown it can be doubled economically without increasing electric rates or without large incentives. I'm wondering, is that being considered in any of the studies that are being performed?
Yeah, so the answer is yes and sort of no. So when we did the study for the water requirements for power generation in Texas, the combined heat and power was considered manufacturing or a different sector, right? So they considered it different, so it was sort of technically outside the scope, and water consumption associated, whatever there is associated with combined heat and power, the data weren't, you know, there wasn't like a readily available data source. But the answer, yes, are people considering that. So the HARC, Houston Advanced Research Center in the Woodlands, who focuses a lot on combined heat and power in general, this is one of their areas to try to emphasize. They're actually interested in trying to emphasize the sort of beneficial aspects of combined heat and power for water consumption. It has, you know, higher energy efficiency. Even if it was had water cooled in some aspect, it would have lower water needs per megawatt hour. So they're, you know, they would be the experts on that. And I know they're interested in promoting that aspect of the mining power, low water or no water.
If it's done right, it uses no water. And that seems to. I know I read one of the reports that said, well, it's more efficient, so it uses less water. Well, that's not true. It actually uses no water because all of the waste heat goes into its process. So there seems to be some misunderstanding about that. And the other thing I would point out on the biomass side and on renewables, you know, it can use any fuel. It typically uses natural gas because that's the most readily available. But when you're using renewable fuels like biomass and geothermal and things like that, it has even more, a much bigger impact than it does even using fossil fuels. Thank you.
Thank you. And I ask the questioners to really make special effort to speak into the microphone so everybody can hear you.
Thank you. My name is Larry Biggins. I'm from Houston, Texas. I'm a graduate of Texas Tech, where I found a great love for water since they hardly ever got any. The big joke was there, Lubbock gets 15 inches a year. That's not very much, and the joke was you ought to be here on the day when it comes. And actually, I think last spring they got 15 inches in one day, and it shut down the campus. Anyway, my question is, I've been involved with facilities engineering in Houston, Gulf Coast area, and in areas that are close to the Gulf Coast where the water table can be as little as 15 feet down to 30 feet, any multi-story building is going to have a dewatering well. This dewatering well pumps into the storm sewer sump pump and then into the storm sewer system. This water is pure, it's clean, it's never been used, so I don't guess it's called gray water. What can we do to use this in, they say two-thirds of your water usage in a large building goes to urinals and sinks. Well, I don't know about you, I've never drinking out of a toilet or a urinal, so I don't know why we're not using this good groundwater that's never been used, instead of sending it into storm sewer, to get the legislation capable where the people along the Gulf Coast, all the way from Corpus, Brownsville, all the way up to the Houston area, and 100 miles in where the water table is not that much, to be able to capture and use this water for urinals and sinks. Thank you.
I'm not an expert in that area, but in certain areas of the world we've looked at, they're tapping into any resource of water they have. This is being considered in certain areas. They don't necessarily have excess groundwater at 15 foot or even 10 foot above the deal, but they're looking at gray water, anything to use for reuse or secondary use. The thing is education, eventually getting to where the actual value and cost of water is considered in these processes. Some of these things will be used as conservation measures when we stop assuming that water is free. And when a lot of these buildings were built, designed, and are still being built, water is still much cheaper than it actually costs to produce.
Well, if you look at the equation backwards, think of all the money you're going to save from not pumping it from your lakes, treating it, and sending it to your buildings if you're getting it right from your building.
One of the things I think you will find, certainly in the water business throughout North America, and Texas is no exception, is the disconnect between the various agencies, producers, pumpers, treaters that are involved between the time a water right is recognized and issued and water actually comes out of a tap somewhere. Communication is a huge piece that's missing. Again, back to education. And I'm certainly not the expert. These gentlemen here may have more detailed comments about it.
You know, I will agree with you on one point. I have never drank out of the toilet either. But having said that, I think this question and the question earlier about rainwater harvesting, to me, really kind of emphasizes this whole point. Much like we're doing in what I will call sustainable energy programs, when you start to think about renewable energy technologies, the whole notion of distributed energy systems is becoming something that the power generators around the country are looking at very seriously. I mentioned earlier, as part of my opening remarks, that CPS Energy, of course, they've just opened up the Blue Wing Project, which is a 14-megawatt solar photovoltaic system located here in San Antonio. They're about ready, again, to open up a contract for 50 megawatts of electric power from photovoltaics located somewhere in the San Antonio region. The point that you raise is a trend that we're going to continue to see relative to water, which is this whole notion of how do you actually think about water from a distributed water resource perspective, as opposed to these large centralized water treatment facilities that occur throughout San Antonio, but quite frankly occur throughout most of the country. And I think over the course of the next 10 years, at least places like the College of Architecture and other parts of the universities are thinking very deeply about how do you think about water from a distributed point of view that's markedly different than what we've done in the past. So I think your point is a very good one. I think a little bit of patience, and perhaps over the course of the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to start to see your ideas being implemented.
I'll just dovetail on that. So, you know, the lead design efforts of buildings, that's where I think this would fall into, right? If you can get it incorporated into these existing ideas about distributed or sustainable house design, this would seemingly fall potentially right in there to incentivize architects to design this into the building.
Well, I heard there was legislation that they were going to start using it in municipalities for government and state buildings, but it died on the floor or something like that. I hope it'll be reintroduced this session. Thank you.
I had a question for John. I'm struggling with your last name.
Brosh.
Oh, thank you. I just want to say thank you for being so innovative in your guys' ideas. I found it very inspiring. I just had a quick question about just really more information about how your technology works. How do you guys go about, it's a two-part question, how do you go about actually clearing the brush? And are you guys innovating or have new techniques for clearing out that brush using really energy-efficient methods? I mean, is it just bulldozers, or are there new techniques you guys explore to reduce the energy when you clear out all that stuff? I just wanted to know more about it.
Well, that's a good question, and it's one that comes up quite often. The most economical and energy-efficient way to do this is the old way, just massive, heavy equipment and mechanical clearing, bulldozers, excavators with grubbers. You do it fast, a lot of acres, in very specific areas. All this is GPS controlled and sculpted before you start in. It's typically big areas. Production and high production is the way to do it. There's nothing new in this. We've been doing this for 100 years here. They've been clearing brush in India and stuff to do this for thousands. So efficiency is that. But the other side, and we have conversations going on, and one of the gentlemen may be in the audience tonight, about converting a lot of that woody biomass, cellulosic biomass, to biodiesel. It theoretically, we could run off of what we harvest. The other thing is by going with high production and large volumes, that attracts the capital it takes to convert this stuff to electricity. It also provides the emphasis, instead of little wood chippers that chip it and mix it up with the dirt, you bring monster wood chippers in there that can harvest 1,000, 1,500 tons a day, which is a lot of trees. So the efficiency is in the scale. The faster the scale, the less you tinker with it, the less fuel you burn. Thank you for the question.
Thank you.
Okay, two more questions.
Hi, my name is Jacqueline King. I'm a graduate student at UTSA in Urban and Regional Planning. And my question really is, I'm brand new to this energy water nexus. I came in pretty much off the street. Someone said, hey, go to this, it's okay. How do I get more information on actually energy loss through line transfer? I'm more interested, we use the water to make energy, and then we produce a lot of energy, then we lose energy. Is there anything in the support increasing or reducing loss and line loss and transfers?
Well, there is a significant amount of work that actually is going on looking at different materials, looking at changing voltages and all kinds of different, I would call, engineering fixes toward that particular problem. And I can put you in touch again with some folks at UTSA that are actively involved in looking at that particular problem as part of the challenges associated with just transmission in general. And the point that you've made is a very good one, because we really haven't talked much about transmission losses. That's one of the challenges that we face with wind generation, even in the western part of Texas, and how you bring that power generated all the way to the major metropolitan areas here in San Antonio and east of San Antonio is a real challenge. And to do that in an efficient way is also a comparable challenge.
Right. So, yeah, Les earlier talked about, so there's, single-digit percentage losses of electricity in the transmission and distribution system, 5, 6, 7%, something like that. So this is one of the motivations to learn about distributed energy for example, the thought is if I distribute it, or if I generate the electricity locally, then I don't have to distribute it from hundreds of miles away. Therefore, I didn't have to incur those transmission losses. So the design challenge from an engineering standpoint is to make the local thing as efficient and cheap as generating electricity as the large power plant, which has large because it has an economy of scale kind of advantage. And traditionally, the fuels have been cheap, so the economies of scale building a large power plant and transmitting that electricity to distributing it to many households has been the way to go. And as resources get more scarce, or if there's things like carbon legislation or a price on CO2, well, then that'll shift the balance of the economics to go more towards local and more distributed aspects. So in terms of the distributed design, this is a forward-looking kind of design methods for provisioning a house, whether that's water or the energy needs of the house, solar thermal. I mean, solar hot water heaters would be another example, right? We didn't mention that, but that's a great way of maybe one of the more obvious sort of energy water things we haven't mentioned yet. I don't need any energy distributed to my house to heat water because it's so hot in Texas already. Why don't I just use that, right? So that actually pays back the fastest of essentially any distributed technology that can go in a house. So your point well taken, and there are a few solutions, so solar hot water heater being one of them, and it's the driver for this distributed design.
Thank you very much for being here. I'm Russell Seal, and I am the political chair of the Alamo Group of the Sierra Club. And we have spent many years fighting CPS Energy, and right now I want to give them accolades and thank CPS Energy and the City Council for bringing Dr. Shepherd to town and having this whole change in the dynamics of this discussion. It's a huge relief for myself and the community. Thank you for being here, and thanks City Council and CPS Energy for giving you the grant to get this done.
That's big.
And Doctor, I'm sorry, I come from a Schuhart background, so I have just as hard a time with your name there.
John Grosch.
I'm very intrigued on your what you're talking about, and I've seen what you're talking on the clearing the brush and stuff. What I am concerned about, though, as we go through this is, and you've addressed some of this, that it has to be very well thought out and pointed. I'm concerned about habitat loss. And what are your plans to address the habitat loss issues and endangered species issues?
Thank you for the question, and that's a good question. And we've talked to Sierra Club before. We've also visited with the Environmental Defense Fund and others. Some of the best protectors of habitat in the world are the ranchers themselves. I was raised that way. We've taken all of this into consideration as best we can. That's part of, we have this mapping technology. We can find the places that this water is, but then a whole series of other events follow on that. We have archaeological surveys. We have habitat surveys. You have the landowner blesses, tweaks, changes it. It's a almost a committee environment before any brush is ever cleared. The other thing you do, and we have done this in the past, our equipment operators go through habitat recognition training. They go through fire and safety training. They help the local volunteer fire department with equipment and stuff like that, run equipment. We furnish those. There's a whole comprehensive thing to find this habitat deal. Bottom line, though, is we have this huge brush sculpting plan. It's loaded GPS into the excavators or the dozers that are doing this project. But the operator, if he gets out there and he sees something that did not pick up, he is required to stop and go around it. So the other side is we know from history that if we make the habitat stronger, that although there's always a bit of impact anytime you come in and change somebody's front yard, even if it's a snail darter down the creek or whatever, there is an impact, but it comes back and thrives and grows. So we're well aware of all of this, and we work with different agencies and stuff to secure it. Dr. Surfe here at Texas Tech, as we go out and do the first demonstration projects, they'll be deeply involved. The Texas State Soil and Water Conservation Board, Parks and Wildlife, all of these people will come in until we get these protocols right. Will we make mistakes from time to time? Absolutely. But My thing is the horny toad. I want to know where the horny toad went.
I want him back so bad.
Want him back.
I miss him.
I do too. So anyway,
Dr. Shepherd probably doesn't know what it is.
It's a good question, but you know, to get into all the details, we could be here for hours discussing all this stuff. But and we will as time goes on. So we'd love to have your input as we go down the road.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Tom is going to close us.
I get the impression from all three of the panelists and Robert that the energy water nexus is relatively new on the radar of a lot of people. And part of that is because we've always had a lot of energy, always had a lot of water. Well, we've got a growing population in the world and the state and the nation. Tell me in a couple of declarative sentences, what's going to happen to the nation if we don't do a better job of addressing the water-energy nexus, especially considering all of the ramifications of climate change as a driving force towards both energy and water?
Well, I'll take a stab at that first. Firstly, I don't want to, nor do I intend to convey an alarmist view. I don't intend to, nor do I want to convey an alarmist view. Recognition of the problem, first and foremost, is critically important, but I will come back to what I'm passionate about, which is education. And for me, I believe this country needs to get back to kind of our roots relative to really focusing on science, technology, engineering, and math education at the earliest levels. Raising the awareness of our young people as to the importance and significance of these issues, the complexity of these issues, because they are interdependent. You've touched on it exactly. Energy, water, climate change, and agriculture. Complex a system as you can find anywhere. We need to be able to resolve and understand those issues. We need to be able to make informed decisions associated with those issues. But I'm convinced innovation and technology insertion will have significant impacts on this whole notion of the energy-water nexus over the course of the coming two decades.
Right. Go ahead. part of the understanding here is energy commodities, for the most part, oil is traded globally, right, across the globe. Natural gas is traded globally in some respects. Not a lot gets imported from overseas here. Water issues are entirely local for the most part in terms of the impact. So it's important for, so one aspect of the water energy nexus is it's important for local areas to have, who live in an area where some potential energy development project may come. They're the ones that are going to live with if the water resources, right, the energy may get shipped somewhere else, right? It's a commodity. It may go stay in Texas. It may go out of Texas. So these are some of the different drivers. There's going to be drivers outside of the local region pressuring the water resources of the local region. So it's important, for the communities to understand these drivers and to speak their voices. The other aspects are somewhat more broad, and so that's a local level. More broad issues, say, now that we're using corn for ethanol in the Midwest and you have runoff into the Gulf of Mexico, affects a dead zone, right? And some people say, oh, biofuels are affecting the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Well, that was agriculture already in general, right? So we've just kind of mixed some agriculture in this particular instance and biofuels. So there are some things that where the energy aspect just gets added and it emphasizes something maybe we were already doing that you may want to, it would be beneficial to look at how we think holistically about water resource management. Energy is now, as we go on, it's just going to highlight that even more. And so the takeaways are there are regions where water restrictions would prevent energy development. Areas, say the oil shale areas in northern Colorado, right? The water is scarce. They need the water. And there are areas where energy restrictions might restrict a water supply. So desalination, if that's used as a solution, there could be, energy restriction that prevents that as being a viable solution, and it'll raise the cost of water or vice versa raise the cost of energy. So the issues can come down to pure economics. So local water issues, global energy issues, and then as you look for new solutions, economics may be the driver for what happens.
A simple declarative sentence. I was actually looking for, and you guys had told me earlier, the simple declarative sentence I was looking for, if we don't do a better job of addressing the water-energy nexus, energy and water are going to get a heck of a lot more expensive than they need to be.
Absolutely.
All right. I want to thank the Witte Museum for being a tremendous host. This is a great facility. You can do me a big favor and the Texas Water Symposium a big favor. Please fill out those forms, evaluation forms. It'll help us do a better job in the future, give us ideas for new topics, and help us proceed forward. And I'd like you to join me in thanking Robert, Les, Carrie, and John for a great job.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks a lot.